Hey everyone, this is Tom Salemi of Device Talks. Welcome back to the Device Talks weekly podcast. Fantastic episode coming your way. I've got a conversation later on with Antoine Papanik. He, of course, is with Sofinnova Partners, and Anne Morrissey. She is the CEO of May Health. We'll talk about May Health, which is a very cool medtech startup, but we'll also talk more broadly about the state of women's health investments. Two people who have had great experience and success in the area, so I wanted to get their take. We'll also hear from Chris Newmarker, and Sean Hooley will be our special guest today. He's going to help us break down the rather unusual partnership between Abbott and Medtronic in the diabetes space. Before we roll into the show, though, please make sure you join us at Device Talks West. It's happening on October 16th and 17th at the Santa Clara Convention Center. You can go to west.devicetalks.com. Our early bird rates are expiring soon, so make sure you go to west.devicetalks.com to register and save yourself a couple $100s. And also check out the speaker list and the agenda. We're continuing to add both discussions and speakers. They're coming in. We're going to have most of the larger OEMs there: Abbott, Baxter, Boston Scientific, Medtronic, Stryker. More and more and more, we'll be focusing on interventional surgical robotics, connected health, neurotech, and other specialties within medtech. So it's going to be a great roll up your sleeves, kind of get into good medtech talk sort of experience. So I honestly and truly hope you'll join us there. Again, go to west.devicetalks.com. All right, you ready for this?
Ready.
Sir,
doing well, Tom. Doing well,
Chris. I'm working on some more music. Ready? You can. Let's see if you can hear this.
Woo-hoo!
It's a little long, but
I like that. That's. I like it. That's
instead of heartbreaker, newsmaker.
I like it. There you go. It's more my speed.
Yeah, that's more your speed.
More of a you're Gen X again. More, I like it. It's good.
All right. Maybe we'll. Hopefully, Pat Neil won't sue us if we
just do a little bit of the riff.
Yeah, just a little bit of the riff.
Just like all right, here's Chris. I've got to just like start taking guitar lessons so I can just bring it on for each episode.
There you go.
Be like,
there you
dun, 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 and then like stick going. Good.
Sounds great. All right, Chris Newmarker.
We have a guest here today. We got Sean Hooley. Hey, man.
We do.
Welcome.
Hey, guys. How's it going?
Sean and I were talking about Sean has seen Pat Benatar in concert.
My first concert in tandem with REO Speedwagon. It was a special event for a 14-year-old.
That's exciting.
Who didn't know either of them very well.
Pat Benatar was my second concert. I think Supertramp was my first. My big brother took me to see Supertramp. So Pat Benatar, that would have been mid-80s. So, yeah, a few years in between mine and yours, Sean. But we have so much in common.
You ever seen Sting live? I've seen Sting.
I have, yeah.
Yeah.
I saw Sting in 1991. Were you alive in 1991? Actually, it was 1989.
No, neither.
Yeah. Well, this conversation's going well. Chris, how are you doing?
I'm doing well, man. There's, you know, Tom, there's big news in Minnesota.
Is it really?
Yep. I was reading today that the price of the unlimited milk at the state fair is going to be $3 instead of $1 this year.
So unlimited milk, is this like a bottomless cup of milk?
Yes. They've got a barn with things that, you fill up cold milk at the fair.
Are you filling up directly from the cows, or
no?
Is there an intermediary
I hope not. I've never heard of, there isn't a cow inside the barn while you're filling it up.
All right.
You don't like pull the thing and hear like a moo inside. No, that's not how it works. You know.
But there, I mean, there's just a natural limit on how much milk you can drink, right? I mean, you can
especially if it's like hot summer weather. I mean, some state fair years, it's, you know, you get some nice 70-degree weather. You know, maybe a cool glass of milk.
I'm Googling, is too much milk dangerous? Bad for you.
Well, since we live in a big dairy part of the country, I would say no. I mean, you know, you can drink as much milk as you want. I mean,
all right, nothing immediate. Consuming too much full-fat milk can contribute to elevated cholesterol levels and increased risk of cardiovascular disease. So, all right. Yeah. I guess they're all not right. being too so reckless at the Minnesota State Fair.
We're helping out the customers, right?
Yeah,
right. Helping out
our products right there.
There we go. Yeah. Yeah, right. Exactly. It's devious. It's so crazy. It just might work.
There's even like a, you know, there's always like some kind of med tech exhibit somewhere at the state fair usually every year. So there you go. So you got like some, you got the milk and then you check out
the little new markers pulling you by the hand saying, daddy, let's go take a look at the aortic valve exhibit.
Totally. Yeah, you got it, yeah. Man.
Forget the Ferris wheel.
That's how we roll. That's how forget that. Forget the mini donuts, you know.
Mini donuts. My son, I bring this up because my son this summer was at a local farm making donuts. And they make like I don't know, I'm holding in my hand like 4-inch diameter donuts, which are good. But he'll come home with like the scraps, like when the donut machine is running out of batter and they just make tiny little blobs of donut. Those are fantastic.
Oh, man.
Entenmann's.
Those awesome.
Are fancy, yeah, the kind of Entenmann's, but they're smaller. And our conversation this summer has been like, why don't they just make all the donuts that size? Because they're better than the actual donuts. So I'm on board with mini donuts.
The deep fried mini donuts, man. Yep. Yeah, we got that going here.
You have unlimited milk and deep fried mini donuts at the fair.
Seriously,
and a medtech exhibit.
And Pronto Pups. Do you know what Pronto Pups are?
I do not know what Pronto Pups are.
Don't know what Pronto. You got it. That's a Minnesota
pups,
thing, man.
Or are they
ice cream treat? They're not to be confused with corn dogs. Corn dogs are hot dogs deep fried with a cornbread batter.
Yes.
Well, Pronto Pups have a pancake batter layer around them.
But they're dogs. They're hot dogs with pancakes.
They're dogs. Yeah. Yeah, the dogs with pancakes. So
it's just like a terrible breakfast sandwich, basically, kind of.
No, they're people who are like, you know, that they got to get their Pronto Pups if they go to the state fair. Right. It's like
McGriddle on a stick.
It's like, yeah, griddle on a stick. I love it. There you go.
Anyway, every time you talk to us about the fair, I just get become more and more intrigued. So, but we're not here to talk about when is the fair, by the way? Are you going? When are you going? Now I need to delve into this. Do you have your date yet?
Just in 2 weeks. Yeah. We haven't bought the tickets yet. Yeah, we'll get
there though. Right. Well,
it's an annual tradition.
We'll get a full report. We actually just as a programming note, we won't have a Device Talks Weekly next week. We'll be rolling out our new podcast, Structural Heart Talks. So that will be coming out next Friday. So just one podcast next Friday. So hopefully by the time we return, Chris, you'll have a state fair story. That would be it.
Tom, some year. We're gonna get this to a point where some year we're gonna do Device Talks Weekly at the fair. I mean, you walk around; they got Minnesota Public Radio stand doing broadcasting. They got, you know, the local TV that will have like Device Talks.
I think that would be fantastic. I
at the fair,
Sean, you'd have to be there for crowd control to keep the people away. Just
keep the people from chugging their unlimited milk too quickly.
No, we want them to do that. That'll help medtech companies
or beer. There is beer being sold.
Unlimited beer?
No. that would be scary.
All right. Dang it. I thought we had a loophole. All right.
Unlimited beer.
Do you have any news, Chris Newmarker? Right. We played the song. Do I have to play it again? Do I have to play the Heartbreaker song?
Yeah, do it again, man.
Don't sue us. Woo! Don't sue us. Okay. All right. All right.
Yep.
That's
all right.
Newsmakers.
All right.
Go ahead, Chris.
Newsmakers. Number 5 on the list is that NeuroOne signed a distribution deal for a neuroablation system, and it brought in more than $5 million. And this is a story. This is actually – let me check here. Oh, my gosh. Every story we are talking about this week was written by Sean here. So, Sean, I mean, what stuck out to you most about the NeuroOne story?
It seemed like it garnered a lot of attention because of sort of the, I don't know, mystique around the partnership, because obviously NeuroOne has a partnership for its electrodes with Zimmer Biomet, and I don't remember when that sort of broke a few years ago. That was a big deal. So obviously there's no named company. There's no real terms of the partnership disclosed at the moment, but I think a lot of people,
it's an undisclosed global medical technology company.
I think a lot of people are intrigued to see what happens with it. And obviously ablation is a big topic in med tech. And when it happens to be in the brain, I think a lot of people are sort of intrigued to see where this goes.
Oh, so this is I was reading radio RF lesions in nervous tissue for functional neurosurgical procedures. I thought this was more along like the spine, but this is for the brain. Interesting.
Yes, and they've got these implanted SEG electrodes that Sean, tell me if I'm remembering this right. It's kind of like this thin film electrodes that kind of like the delivery system is like, you know, it's kind of almost like it's like through a kind of like needle like device through the skull, basically.
Yeah. So what they do there, but they're at the subsurface level of the brain and provide up to 30 days of recording, monitoring, and stimulation. So sort of a wide variety of options, but minimally invasive. So the whole sort of draw is that they don't need to remove the top of the skull to implant them.
Exactly. Yeah, because a lot of these neuro devices, there's some kind of skull removal going on. Well, like this, they don't, and you know, and they've had this you know, partnership with, you know, Zimmer Biomet to use their electrodes with Zimmer's ROSA robotic system. So so now it's interesting that they've got this this, you know, neuro ablation system on top of that. So you've got the electrodes, you know, then you're adding an ablation. So yeah, it's really, really fascinating company. So it's going to be neat to see what happens next.
All right. Great. Number five, let's roll on to number four, Chris Neumarker.
Hey, number four on the list, we've got Pentax winning an FDA nod for a duodenoscope with new sterilization tech. It actually uses a hydrogen peroxide sterilization, which is, you know, there's been a lot of buzz around this type of sterilization, like it's hydrogen peroxide gas plasma sterilization to be exact, because, you know, ethylene oxide, which has been widely used in the industry, you know, there's just been a lot of challenges around it, new EPA rules. So, and, you know, duodenoscopes have had a lot of sterilization challenges of their own in the past, you know, so it's kind of neat to see this example of you know, of like something you know, moving forward with the hydrogen peroxide sterilization.
And I'd like to point out that this was not chosen because the hydrogen peroxide glass plasma sterilization was developed by Advanced Sterilization Products, which is a past sponsor of Device Talks at Device Talks Boston, actually. So
there we go. It's just there. It's a lot of news.
Just a coincidence. It actually is just a coincidence. So good job for ASB developing this tech. Obviously, sterilization is a huge deal. Sean, you wrote this as you wrote everything else in this week's Newsmakers. You are Mr. Newsmaker. Yeah. Anything to add?
No, I think Chris mostly covered it. Emphasized that, you know, in the time that I've covered the industry, ETO has definitely been something that seems like it's talked about all the time. So anything to move away from that and be more sort of environmentally friendly. And obviously, the Pentax themselves said that this came in response to FDA and CDC calls for advanced designs to reduce cross-contamination. So it seems like they're kind of answering the call.
Fantastic. All right, Chris Neumarker, what's number three on the Neumarker's Newsmakers?
Well, number three on the list, we've got Allurion Technologies announcing their suspending sales of their Allurion balloon from the market in France. And Allurion is based in Massachusetts, developer of like an artificially intelligence powered gastric balloon for weight loss, but the National Medicine Safety Agency in the country, like requested that they, you know, withdraw it over implementation of an action plan. So hopefully this gets resolved soon. I mean, Allurion was saying questioned the decision to ask them to pull it from the market there, but they're made a cooperative with them and getting a risk reduction program in place.
Sean, anything more on the Allurion product? Do they know if they have approval anywhere else or if they're working with some others on this technology?
Well, I know they have a partnership with Medtronic on the platform They partnered with them last year mm-hmm. to advance the technology and had some positive data for the balloon. So as far as I know, it's no influence on other geographies that the device is available. But I was sort of taken aback by it. Grand scheme, it's not strong language, but to come out and say that they question the decision but remain cooperative is quite interesting.
All right. Yeah. Well, we'll track that story. Chris Neumarker, let's roll on to number two.
Number two on the list, we've got Cosmo Intelligent Medical Devices announcing FDA clearance for the next generation of the GI Genius hardware that's distributed by Medtronic. This is like the sixth generation of the hardware, and this latest iteration also includes FDA-cleared ColonPro software, and this helps identify potential polyps and standardized quality metric reporting during a during colorectal cancer screenings. But we had a demonstration of a GI Genius at a previous live device talks event. I mean, it's really cool technology, and it's a good example of the use of AI in medtech right now. Like that they have this the software for colonoscopy procedures that kind of puts these boxes around like things that that a gastroenterologist might want to look at more during the procedure, like help them more accurately diagnose what's going on.
Oh, interesting. And I'm just reading an article that Jim Hammerand wrote for Medical Design and Outsourcing. It came out July 9th. The title of which, the headline, How Cosmo Cranked Up Cancer-Catching AI Behind Medtronic's GI Genius ColonPro. Cosmo Pharmaceuticals Division developed a neural network that allows ColonPro to spot signs of colon cancer that physicians might miss during a colonoscopy. So they're developing the basically the software and the neural networks. Sean, is that... is that the relationship?
Medtronic does the distribution. Cosmo Pharma's Intelligent Medical Devices unit is the one sort of developing the technology behind the GI Genius. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's obviously we've sort of operated with Medtronic at Device Talks events, and I know you've had Gio DiNapoli on, who's now formerly with Cosmo rather than Medtronic, I believe, on the podcast before. But yeah, it's seemingly a pretty fruitful partnership. And as you mentioned, the MDO article from Jim, there are, I think, three linked in the article on Mass Device. So if you want to see sort of more in-depth dives into what the technology is, it's all there.
Yeah. I mean, this causes like more than, 50,000, colon cancer causes like more than 50,000 deaths in the U.S. Each year. So, I mean, anything that can, make colonoscopies more, effective to catch this early is great.
Oh, and I thank you for bringing up Gio DiNapoli. I know he had left for a business called Cosmo Pharmaceuticals, but I didn't realize they had a relationship with Medtronic at the time. So I just assumed when I saw Cosmo, I'm like, I wondered if it was the same company, and it is. So they're based in Ireland, and I know Gio had talked about wanting to relocate back to Europe. So seems like it was a great fit, and they continue to do good work together with Medtronic. So, all right.
Good deal.
Chris Neumarker, let's roll into number one, which is the reason we have the great Sean Hooley here on this week's Newsmakers.
Well, number one, there's just a really, really interesting major partnership announced in the diabetes tech space, and I'll pass the floor over to Sean here. Sean, tell us more about it.
Yeah, so Abbott and Medtronic have partnered up to collaborate on a system, a CGM that would be based on Abbott's very popular Freestyle Libre continuous glucose monitor and pair with Medtronic's automated insulin delivery technology. Obviously, the sort of flagship is the MiniMed 780G pump, and then you have the InPen system for people who don't want, a wearable pump. They use the smart pen delivery instead. So yeah, it's obviously two huge names in med tech that are pairing up to work on CGMs, and sort of the big takeaway is that Medtronic has only ever used in-house CGMs to pair with their own insulin delivery technology. Obviously, we've seen Abbott and Dexcom pair their CGMs with Insulet and Tandem and Beta Bionics, to name a few. So this is sort of a new, I suppose, road for Medtronic to go down in terms of using the Abbott technology. It will be exclusive to Medtronic devices, so this isn't sort of a next-gen CGM that Abbott will be able to, throw around to anyone who wants to pair it with their device. It'll be an exclusive partnership that analysts definitely seem to believe will be beneficial to both parties.
Looking at the, if I remember correctly from the article, I think they definitely viewed the partnership as a positive for the both partnering organizations and the companies you mentioned, Dexcom, Insulet, in tandem, each took a little bit of a ding in their stock price too, sort of suggesting that this may not be great news for them. Certainly not debilitating or deadly news for them, but not great news for them.
Yeah, I think the main takeaway was sort of Dexcom as a CGM sort of rival of Abbott might take a hit, and Tandem as sort of the most like-for-like pump rival of Medtronic, if you will, took a hit. Insulet less so, only because the form factor of Omnipod is much different than anything Medtronic offers. Obviously, yeah. Medtronic is looking to get into the patch pump game. They tried to acquire that Korea-based EOFlow, and that fell through. But there was also discussions about in-house development. So that may, you know, come to the fore down the road. But for the time being, Insulet doesn't really seem to take a huge fallout from this. But it's definitely investors were not as high on those companies yesterday as perhaps they would have been the day before.
Well, especially because Abbott's seen so much success with the Freestyle Libre like CGMs. I mean, it's kind of like the CGMs. And tell me if I'm right, Sean. I mean, the CGMs are getting a lot of excitement right now, you know, for helping out people with diabetes, or really like Dexcom's CGMs, and then, you know, the apps, you know, Abbott Freestyle Libres.
Yeah, they're the two clear front runners. To be honest, it's something I should know, but I can't tell you necessarily which one has a larger base, but they both, you know, they reach a large population within the diabetes community. There are other CGM makers. I know Senseonics has its implantable long-term one, but that is similar to the way Insulet's different from Medtronic's pumps. It's a different form factor. It's a different sort of desire for a person with diabetes to want that long-term implantable. A lot of people find the ease of use of the application for the Dexcom and Abbott ones. They're really small and just they're definitely the big ones, and they're the ones that connect with insulin pumps right now. So obviously they already have that established ground, and now Abbott's sort of taken the next step, a bigger leap.
The idea that, yeah, that the Freestyle, that there's going to be a version of the Freestyle Libre that's like exclusive for Medtronic insulin pumps, which, I mean, it'll be interesting to see how much that like leads people who you know, like Abbott CGMs to be like, well, if I need an insulin pump, then I should use a Medtronic pump, because, you know, there's a version of the Freestyle Libre that goes well with it.
And someone who uses, say, a Tandem pump but likes the Libre can now look at Medtronic's pump and say, oh, does this offer more? Or, you know, not to pit the two against each other, but that sort of is the case. And then according to the analyst, Medtronic's pumps and insulin delivery devices extend to 700,000 people. So that adds, you know, potentially 700,000 users to Abbott's, you know, back pocket. And one, Travis Steed at Bank of America, said it likely adds $100 million or more in growth per year for Libre. So it's a pretty big jump.
Yeah.
Oh, and creative move by Medtronic. I mean, they've been looking at the diabetes business for a couple of years now. Earlier on, there was talk of whether it was going to be a spin-out target, and then they brought in Q Dallara to kind of lead things up. So it sounds like a
kind of a turnaround.
Yeah, kind of a creative solves.
Another interesting thing on the Abbott front, too, is that the analysts say that this sort of quells any talk of Abbott pursuing its own pump, whether that be in-house or through acquisition.
So oh, that's interesting.
This deal seems to be put paid to the idea that Abbott could be pushing for its own pump.
Yeah, you wonder if there's something in the partnership that they wouldn't do that. You know, if they bought an Insulet or something, and then suddenly they become a rival to Medtronic as opposed to just supplier in this particular space. But certainly, something to watch. And as you've both been talking, I've been trying to think if there's been any other partnerships that I could think of between two large market cap leaders like this one. Nothing comes to mind. If our listeners think of something and want to put something in a LinkedIn comment, feel free to, or obviously shoot us an email or a message on LinkedIn. We'd love to.
I remember there was a rumor, like in the past that, like there was some, like one of those anonymous source reports saying that I think it was, do you remember, Sean? It was like, I think it was like Dexcom's going to buy Tandem. And I remember
it was Dexcom and Insulet. And there was sort of, it was a, you know, I think it might've been Bloomberg reporting or Wall Street Journal. It was people close to the situation, and both companies immediately said, no, no shot.
It was actually unusual because a lot of times when those reports, they just there's just the standard, you know, like we don't comment on rumors like response. But this one actually had a flat out like no, that's not true. We're not doing that. So,
but that could be something that is revisited now that this partnership exists. If Dexcom or Insulet feels that they need to sort of make a big leap, I don't know.
Yeah.
No, great point.
We'll keep following it. So it's an exciting space to follow.
See, oh, yeah. Chris, I told you Sean was worth having on. You were like, no, I got this, but I, you know.
Thank goodness. Ode to be a fly on the wall.
That might not have been exactly how the conversation went. I might be misremembering. I'm not sure.
Tom.
All right, guys. Thanks, Sean, for the insights. Chris Neumarker, you're a heartbreaker. I mean, a newsmaker. And we'll talk to you not next week, but in 2 weeks. We'll be back on Device Talks Weekly with more Neumarker's newsmakers.
It'll be awesome.
This is Tom Salami of Device Talks. We're excited to bring you another great program for Device Talks West here at the Santa Clara Convention Center, talking new business models, new missions, and new intentions. I can't wait until we fill this auditorium with MedTech's best engineers, entrepreneurs, and executives. This is Device Talks West.
The foundation of connected care is the who we are that drives the what we do. We shape our environment, and then our environment shapes us.
Thoughtful discussions of how it impacts not only markets, but society and the workforce.
What is it doing for the patient? And that's what our technology needs to be.
I look at what the standard of care is today. Are there areas where we can improve upon the standard of care, or are there areas where there are significant gaps? And that's what drives me.
What am I trying to accomplish? You know, getting back to that core, what problem am I trying to solve? Am I going to do something new and really move the needle for patient outcomes? So there's a ton of work to be done, and that's what keeps me excited.
Why did you choose MedTech? Find out at Device Talks West on October 16th and 17th. Register at west.devicetalks.com.
The folks that are saving lives, they're all here.
I now begin our conversation with Antoine Papanicki. He is the managing partner at Sofinnova Partners, and Anne Morrissey. She's the CEO of May Health. Antoine Papanicki and Sofinnova, of course, have backed many of the more successful medtech startups, including companies like CoreValve and Shockwave. And Anne Morrissey is leading May Health after a successful stint as a CEO at another women's health company called Alydia Health that would go on to be acquired. All right, let's listen. Well, Anne Morrissey and Antoine Papanek, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Tom.
Thank you for having us.
Excited to talk about May Health and women's health in general, investments in women's health companies. I like to explore that a bit. But before we get into that, I want to understand your paths to where you are today, how you found your way into the medtech industry. And maybe you can lead us off. What was it that lured you into the medtech industry, and you know, what makes you stay?
Yeah, so I've been in the medtech industry the majority of my career. I started out in kind of sales, marketing, early strategic roles, but very quickly found an interest in women's health because it was an underserved area. And now that I'm at this stage of my career, I am dedicated to that and wanting to be able to make an impact. And I see it's a big, as Antoine and I have discussed, it's a huge white space, and there's a lot of unmet needs. Where we can make a difference clinically as well as economically, and have healthcare impact. So that's where I am today.
In medical devices in general, just what was it that drew? Was just a happenstance, serendipity that led you here, or was this a life's goal when you were just a child?
Yeah, just a child. I always wanted to be in medical devices. I grew up. Father was a physician. I think, like many of us, were maybe at some point wanted to be doctors. So, you know, I was always interested in and surrounded by medicine. And then I had an opportunity right out of university to join a company in their healthcare division. And from the first surgery, I was hooked, just by the, you know, the procedure and They had to drag me out of the first step.
Yeah, I was going to say, once you see that, I'm sure, like, well, what am I going to do, working in an office with a cubicle? Like, no, this is too cool. Yeah. Antoine, how about you? I know you'd started Unilever, and then you started VC, and then you were early on, 1997, like right when this all began to rise, the medtech industry. What was it about medtech that drew your interest as an investor? Were you an investor at that point, or were you doing something else?
Yeah, no, I became a healthcare investor in 95 in another firm than Sofinnova, and I joined Sofinnova in 97. But already one of my first deal was a medtech deal. It was called Sometech. It was a cardiovascular deal. We actually sold this. The founder of this is a gentleman called Jia Asquith, who is a venture partner with Sofinnova 30 years later. So, you know, it's about people often, and certainly having had an early exposure to what you can do in devices and how you can treat unmet medical need and change people's lives. I think it's once you have it, it's difficult to change. So, you know, I've been very fortunate to have encountered amazing people, you know, Jacques Seguin at CoreValve, and we've done many things with him since then. Of course, I was involved with CoreValve, but also with Recor, with Shockwave, with, you know, a bunch of people who have just transformed, you know, patients' lives. And I get excited with people just trying to change the course of diseases. It happens that, and I never wanted to be a doctor, to be honest. I always thought, you know, I was going to be a business guy, but both my parents were physicians. In fact, my father, if I may say this, my late father was an obstetrician. In fact, he was the first one to do an IVF in France back in 1983 or something like that. I can't remember. So infertility, you know, women's health, I wouldn't say it was sort of, I had it at home because that's what my father used to do. You know, so for me, that was very natural. So from, you know, the second I saw, and we're going to talk about that, but the second I saw May Health, I thought, well, that makes total sense. So that connected a lot of the things I had heard about from my childhood onwards to my medical device practice as an investor.
That's fascinating. I mean, I want to get into women's health and May Health in a moment, but you've been involved with so many. You mentioned several, CoreValve, Shockwave. What is it that you? Is there a trait? Is there a quality that is consistent amongst all of these companies? Is it the founder you've connected with? Is it the technology? Is it the opportunity? You're going to say it's all three, but what is really sort of, what do you latch on to? Do you latch on to one thing? Do you latch on to a bunch of things when you're identifying a company that you think is going to be the next big thing?
I'll say it's all three for sure.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
because look, first of all, you have to ask yourself the question, what if they're right? You know, what if this physician entrepreneur is right, and does it make a difference? And if the answer is no, then don't bother. If the answer is yes, maybe, and this is what you need to do, then, you know, this technology and people interface is what makes the difference. In all the success stories that I've been involved with, this was what made it possible. So of course, you know, a lot of it has been in cardiovascular historically because of how important, how, of course, the diseases, etc. But as you explore, you realize that in, you know, many other fields, in surgery, in women's health, there are fields where, yeah, there are huge unmet medical needs. We're going to talk about May Health. 10% of the women population. I mean, how bigger can you get? So, mm-hmm. You know, if you have the right combination of technology and people, I think, and the market, and the answer to the question, what if they're right, is yes, of course, it's going to change people's lives. This is how I get excited.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's great. Well, let's focus on the conversation around women's health. And maybe you can kind of kick us off. And let's first talk about the problem or the shortage of support for these companies. Or I'm already jumping ahead. Is there a shortage of funding? Is there a shortage of financial support? Is there too little attention being paid to ventures that can help women overcome health problems or make them healthier, is what I should say.
Yeah. It's a question, and everybody asks that about women's health. And yeah. I would say, you know, having been in this kind of in the trenches for close to a decade, specifically in women's health, that it's gotten a lot better. And I would say there's two things I think that are different today than 10 years ago is that people will take a meeting just on women's health. I think every investor that I met with says we would like to invest in women's health. So I think that's a move in the right direction. I think the other really important thing that's happened in the field is that there's a lot of early stage, smaller funds that I think are helping in that really early stage from kind of branching from maybe friends and family and angel funding over to maybe a real Series A or actually helping with a Series A to get some of these companies a little bit further along and develop proof of concept than they can launch to a more established venture investor. So I think that there's definitely more funding. I would say, you know, with that, the caveat I would say is that I do think that the bar is still higher. And I think that there's a default by many investors to invest in areas that they know intimately. An incremental change in something in a market that they understand, where they understand adoption and all of the challenges, is sometimes easier for as an investment than investing in a field where, if you look at the history in women's health, there's been some companies who haven't done so well. And I think some of those scars are very deep for certain investors. Mm-hmm. And in the space, I think that's still a challenge. But I think, I look at Alydia, and I look at what we're doing at May Health, and, you know, in addition to making an impact for women, from a health perspective and making a return on investment, I think it's also really important for us to kind of continue to raise the bar in the field for women's health. The more exits there are, the more people are attracted to this as an investment opportunity. I will say, Antoine, I know you'd love to hear what Antoine has to say, but Antoine, I think one of the first times we sat down, I said, I think it's amazing that you've made this huge bet in women's health. And he was like, I saw a huge market opportunity. and I think that some investors think of them separately. And I think Antoine's an early, is a leading thinker and just thinking it as a market opportunity.
No, I think that's a great point. Antoine, I wanted to go over to you. I mean, VCs aren't philanthropists. They're not going to invest in an area that's right because it's the right thing to do. There needs to be a market there. And I would think, because there are so many women in the world, there'd be a huge market for women's health. I didn't get an MBA, but I'm just kind of, so number one, has there been a dearth of investment in this space in your opinion? And that's just your opinion. And number two, if so, do you see that attitude changing and why?
Yeah, there has been a dearth of investment in the space. I can't really tell you why. I mean, often women get on with things. You know, it's like, if you don't complain, and then no one pays attention in a way. And those are the facts of life. And I think it's less and less possible to accept that. And I think many of the women's health indications were misdiagnosed, but also misjudged, and we didn't talk about it. So as things, you know, endometriosis, okay, nobody cared about endometriosis. Now, it's like, I don't know, in some European countries, France in particular, this is like, there's a national plan for endometriosis. Like, you cannot not serve half of the world population. And sounds pretty obvious, not for philanthropic ideas. There must be a market to address this. That's one thing. And then, of course, there's fertility. I mean, not being able to conceive is, and I know that again from way before being an investor in the space, hearing this in my family, because of my father's, being a fertility specialist, among other things, as an obstetrician, Yeah, it's horrible. I mean, when you have a disease, it's horrible, but not being able to conceive is something that people cannot accept. And I think this is how IVF went to be born. And this is how, you know, the original technology behind what we now have at May Health was originally conceived. So, you know, you put all this together, there's a massive population. There are people who actually will go a huge amount of, I mean, a very long way. These people are not sick in any other way. They just can't conceive and have babies. So if you can help them to do that, then that's going to transform their lives and the lives of their families. So just, you don't have to, it's not rocket science to think right. that's important and that there must be a way to actually turn this into a market opportunity and therefore a business opportunity that ultimately investors will make money on.
Absolutely. Oh, and my son, my oldest son's birthday is tomorrow, and it took us a good long time for that to happen. And it's definitely not having that opportunity. It's a quality of life issue, and it's a health issue. So that's a very, very great point. So Anne, I want to explore the infrastructure of women's health and if there are more opportunities at the strategic level. We have companies now like Hologic that are obviously focused on women's health. The larger strategics are building businesses centered around women's health. As an entrepreneur, when you're going to pitch to someone like Antoine, are you able to point to more opportunities for an exit? Like, look, we could be acquired by this company, this company, this company. And if so, I have to imagine that makes your job easier when raising money and finding investors.
Yeah. So the strategic environment for women's health is, I think, more robust now than it has been historically. I think there, and I would also say specific to what we're doing at May Health, although our long-term big goal is to be able to treat PCOS in general, our first indication is for PCOS-related infertility. And there are a lot of strategics that are very interested in infertility assets. So be able to either, and there's two things I think that are happening. There's one, I think, you know, there's the Hologic, there's the Coopers, there's also this crossover with pharma. So we see, you know, Organon bought Alydia. I think we see Ferring also with some interest in crossing over, not just doing being in the pharma world, but also being in the device world. So I think that's an interesting trend that we're starting to see emerge. And then I think there's a lot of other, some of the big device players that are thinking about, I want to get into women's health, and how could I do that? And I think infertility is one of those areas where there is interest in, particularly in an asset like what we're working on. So I think there's a lot that's happening there. And I think of that as less of maybe an issue than historically has been the case. And certainly, again, I'm experiencing that currently through the lens of May Health and what we're working on here.
Mm-hmm. So. And Antoine, could you add to that and maybe give a little more of a global perspective as well? Do you see a broader corporate interest in infertility globally from other companies? And just, if you could just add to what Anne was saying as an investor.
So fertility for sure. I mean, fertility is an area where there has been, it's a very business savvy opportunity. Yeah. So, the IVF clinic is our profit centers. And that means that the idea that you can actually make money in, developing a therapy that would address some of the unmet medical need is already there. And yes, corporates are more numerous now and more interested than they used to be. But I would say I will make a comment that I've seen being true for other sectors, including cardiovascular. I think in the field of medtech, of course, there's a number of acquirers. But if you compare medtech to biotech, there's a much, much smaller universe of buyers. Right. And I think companies to succeed nowadays, at least, and, you know, I would say that's maybe it was different 20 years ago, need to actually build their business. And I think this is what that's very interesting in May Health, is that you actually can you build the business by yourself? There are areas where it's impossible to build a business by yourself. Look at Shockwave, of course. You know, the success of this is that they have built a business that ultimately became just an amazing growing opportunity that ultimately was irresistible for J&J, and that's something that is possible in the field of infertility using MayHealth. As Anne said, I think what's very, very interesting about MayHealth is that infertility treatment is our first indication, and that there may be other opportunities, much broader, in fact, opportunities in treating polycystic ovary syndrome, which is a metabolic disease. And these women have a lot more risk of, Anne will come up to that in a second, but that opportunity is much, much bigger than just fertility. So if we can build a business in fertility, and then we can then explore the rest of the PCOS, polycystic ovary syndrome, issues, you know, that you can build a business for the longer haul. And I think that's a recipe that you need to have to be a self-standing company in medtech.
Great. Well, we've dropped a lot of breadcrumbs about MayHealth, and why don't you introduce us to the company? People are wondering, what? Tell me more. So tell me more about MayHealth. You mentioned PCOS a few times. Tell us a bit more about PCOS and what solution are you hopefully developing?
Yeah. So MayHealth is we're clinical stage. We have a device treatment for polycystic ovarian syndrome. So PCOS is a lifelong endocrine disorder. It's something that starts when a young woman hits puberty and will affect her across her lifespan. So everything from kind of early on insulin resistance, so issues maintaining weight, hirsutism, so very like facial hair or losing scalp hair, so male patterned hair, and cystic acne at an early age. None of those things are very, very well liked, but oftentimes young women are just put on birth control pill to manage some of the symptoms. And then when they hit kind of fertility years, they realize they have PCOS, which is where our first indication is. But the other effects of PCOS are stunning to me, that there are no treatments today for PCOS. It affects women, 50% of women by the time they're 40, if they have PCOS, will have type 2 diabetes. They're at much higher risk for cardiovascular disease, mental health issues, and then they're at much higher risk for maternal mortality, morbidity. There's a lot of complications around pregnancy associated with PCOS. So it's something that has this incredible impact across a lifespan. And the underlying problem for women is that their bodies, they're making too much, too many androgens. And so that is actually how we're treating it. So androgens are predominantly made in the ovary. And we have a treatment that we utilize radiofrequency energy, and we actually destroy some of the tissue in the ovary. So we reduce the amount of androgen production that is done, and we kind of reset, or as we call it, rebalance the hypothalamic ovarian pituitary axis. And so a woman can start menstruating normally, ovulate normally, and be able to get pregnant. And then also for treating those androgens, we're addressing all of those other issues that a woman has. So it's a really incredible opportunity. The napkin moment, as I would say, for the company was when somebody thought of, there's a surgical procedure called laparoscopic ovarian drilling that we're based upon. And taking that, so we knew clinically, and there's a lot of clinical data that shows if you ablate tissue in the ovary, you get this effect of resetting resetting a woman's ovulation. And so we took that and we made it into very similar to a procedure called an egg retrieval, which is something that every reproductive endocrinologist does as a course of business. They have, you know, they have the skill set, they have the equipment. And so we are adding a device and a generator to that room where they can do this procedure almost exactly like they would do an egg retrieval. So that is what we're doing at MayHealth.
And what does the device look like? Is it going to be a self-standing cart that kind of is wheeled in, wheeled out? And if you could just get a little more detailed into what exactly will be happening to the physically to the woman, what's the treatment look like?
Yeah. So the equipment looks like, so there's a generator instead of envisioning rolling in a cart, imagine a laptop. So it's a very simple generator, okay. Small, can sit on a tabletop in the room. And then the device itself is, it looks like actually can't see my hands all the way, but it's a long needle. And it's the same length and diameter as an egg retrieval needle. And that is loaded on top of a transvaginal ultrasound probe, and then inserted transvaginally. We puncture the vaginal wall, and then we go into the ovary. We puncture the ovary. And then once we're inside the ovary, we deploy a catheter that then delivers the radiofrequency energy. So it's a really cool design. It's a very simple design. And the only place mm-hmm. it really differentiates from an egg retrieval is when we deploy the catheter into the ovary.
Interesting. Yeah. So Antoine, I'd love to get your first take on when you were pitched the idea. What was appealing? There's a lot of familiar technology there, a lot of family familiarity as well with your father's history. What opportunity did you see in this investment?
Well, I think what Ant said, which is pretty important, is that there was a surgical predicate.
Yep.
Often, you know, people have great ideas and say, oh, I'm sure it's going to work. Here, you know, it is working because there are hundreds of thousands of patients that have undergone this ovarian drilling, a pretty nasty terminology, but describing what they used to do surgically. And this sort of got, and this is, by the way, in all the guidelines in the US, in Europe, in China, across the world, because this has been used over decades and decades. It became less used because women didn't want a surgical intervention. This was another time where, in fact, ultrasound was not so prevalent, and you would actually have a laparoscopic view of the ovaries to determine the diagnosis of PCOS, of polycystic ovaries. You look at those ovaries and you realize that they are polycystic, and at the time they would then treat. That has disappeared with, you know, very fancy ultrasound, and then IVF came along, and people said, "Oh, IVF will solve everything." IVF does not solve everything. So a lot of these patients do not actually want IVF. They can't afford IVF. There's also a lot of issues with IVF. So the first thing, just to answer your question, is huge, massive demonstration clinically that this works. Now, like many cases in device, can you transform a surgical technique into a minimally invasive technique? Take core valve. It's the same. You know, you have a heart surgeon doing a valve repair, valve replacement, surgically opening your thorax, arresting your heart, etc., and then you go through a catheter and you do that percutaneously. It's exactly the same. You have a surgical predicate. You know it works. Can you do it minimally invasively? So that theme has been probably the biggest theme of device over the last, you know, 20, 30 years, is make it minimally invasive, and then, you know, the physicians will take it, and then the patients will want to have this too. The big thing and the risk we took was, can we do this in a minimally invasive way in an office procedure? And this is what Anne has been able to demonstrate clinically, that indeed you can transform something where with general anesthesia to an office procedure. Maybe that's more for Anne to describe.
Yeah, I'd love to learn about that. But just also quickly, what's the origin of the technology? Where was it developed, or who developed it?
Anne, do you want to comment on that?
Sure. Or? So it actually originated. I feel like we've come full circle in the Bay Area. The founders were here in the Bay Area, and that technology was then purchased by MDStart, which is part of Sofinnova. It's an incubator that develops technologies. And then I was introduced to them actually via a recruiter who was looking for a CEO to take the technology and start marching towards a pivotal trial for the technology. So so it did originate in the U.S. So it has U.S. and French origins.
Oh, excellent! And were they clinicians who developed this idea, or engineers, or
so both.
Both. Yeah. Okay. Typical medtech story. Yeah.
Yes.
Yes. Fantastic. So where are you in clinical trials now? You mentioned clinical trials, and what does the path forward look like?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. So we've treated 32 patients. So we ran a feasibility. So when I joined before I signed, I saw a case. So case number 6. And then we've treated 27 of those patients were treated in Europe and then 5 in the US. With that data, we went to the FDA with a pivotal trial design last year, which they approved. And we just after we closed our Series B, we just treated our first 2 patients in our pivotal trial. So we're running a pivotal trial that should take about a year for enrollment. And then that will be the data that we'll submit for PMA to the FDA.
And what's the clinical pathway, did you say?
PMA. So we're on a PMA.
PMA. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. And do you have a sense of reimbursement yet? You're probably not there. They're obviously paying for surgeries. So,
right. So I will say one of the beauties of our business model is that we are first going for a fertility indication. So our primary endpoint for this clinical trial is the restart of ovulation. We're also looking at pregnancy, and we're also looking at a whole host of cardiometabolic factors. And we will follow these patients for 3 years so we can look at the full PCOS impact. But the first indication in how reimbursement will work is it's a cash pay procedure. So 75% of fertility in the United States is out of pocket cash pay. The 25% that is covered by some sort of fertility coverage, most of it is unallocated dollars, and they can utilize those funds for our procedure if they choose during the process of it. We are also in parallel. We are starting to think about how this could ultimately. To me, the big win is we get this covered by insurance as a medical procedure for women who have PCOS. Shouldn't really be lumped into fertility, but it is, and that is makes it a great way for us to be able to access this market in an easier way.
Antoine, how do you see the growth of this company happening? We've talked about the multiple applications that could be. I imagine it's going to require a lot more financing or unless this product is going to generate the cash that's going to fuel that expansion. How do you view that expansion happening financially and operationally?
Well, to the point I was making earlier, this is also part of our thesis, is that certainly the first indication is one where you can actually develop your own business. You know, IVF clinics is a very distinct path in the U.S. There's a number of those. They are, as I said, very business savvy. They need to understand what's in for them, that it's an efficient way of getting more patients or retaining those patients, maybe failed IVF or patients that don't want or cannot afford IVF. So the business case is one that we believe in, and that we need to, of course, upon approval, be able to develop a strategy to conquer that market. That, I think, by itself is one where, you know, I think we could become a self-standing company and do that for you know, grow that business internationally, by the way, for many years. Actually, infertility is also a big business in Europe. In general, it's like skewed towards the US, but Europe is also a big business. And if you think about other geographies, I was mentioning China earlier, there are opportunities worldwide in finding solutions that are efficient in treating infertility. So that's how we're looking at this. You know, let's baby steps. You know, let's get this through clinical trials approval, and then let's build the business and see how that goes.
Do you feel at the start of this, you mentioned when we talked about women's health and the dearth of financing in there, there was a discussion about, and you mentioned, you know, some of the companies that didn't succeed, and that maybe cast a pall over the sector. Do you feel any additional pressure running a company like this when having identified as a women's health company to succeed? Does that add any more oomph to what you're already doing? I mean, you're already doing a lot, so I'm thinking not, but I'm just kind of curious, as a CEO, do you feel like you're carrying a little more?
You know, I personally, absolutely. I feel, yeah. I feel a, you know, a responsibility to, you know, first and foremost to the patients to bring an option, also to, you know, my investors for a return on their investment, but also I think just to the larger women's healthcare landscape. I think, you know, every success begets more success. I mean, I think when I look at what we did at Alydia and how that's really, really catalyzed a lot of interest and a lot of investment in women's health, you know, it's important and it matters. And I think, you know, I wanted to tack on to something that Antoine mentioned about this opportunity. I mean, I think when we look at this commercially, this is a, this is just for the fertility. It's a $10 billion opportunity, and our ability to be able to access that while we're pursuing kind of a larger indication, even if with a larger indication, we're not an option, which it is. We're treating an ovary, and we're helping a woman actually reset her androgens. We're treating her PCOS. There's no question about it. It's really more of a regulatory exercise than anything. But we've got this incredible multi-billion dollar opportunity that we can go after. And it's in this very discrete set of, you know, 500 in the United States, it's 500 fertility centers. So it's a very discrete universe of physicians. It's, you know, under 2,000 physicians in those centers. So we are, you know, I think it's makes for a really, really executable business for success.
And Antoine, we've gone over the last couple of questions. We've gone over all the very impressive reasons why this could succeed and the size of the market. I mean, it sounds like as a podcaster, I almost feel like I'm doing a disservice by constantly focusing on women's health, but that's kind of where I went into this conversation. But this is just a good medtech company. I mean, this is everything you've told me, whether it was a heart company, it's just a good medtech company. I mean, I think at some point we'll get past having conversations about women's health. I think it's important to talk about now. But how do you view this company? Is it part of a women's health portfolio? Is it just a medtech company? What, I guess, do you want to have a, you already have a great legacy in medtech, but do you want this to sort of be a flag for women's health? How do you view this, the future of this company? That's a big question. I apologize. I don't know where the hell I'm going with it, but.
I mean, first of all, I think changing standard of care is I get a kick about that. Sorry to say, but you know, I mentioned some of the companies I've been involved with. Think Recor and Reland Innovation. I mean, you know, it took us 10 years and at some point people were just thinking, oh, my poor Antoine, you're in a renal denervation company. But look, if you can treat hypertension with a device, wouldn't you want to do that? Change the standard of care and everything that goes with this? It's the same here. So, of course, you know, I mentioned I started with, you know, I, of course, it's like full circle with for my father's effort in finding solutions for women who can't conceive to this. But has nothing to do with, it's a nice add-on. For me, it's another medtech company. My responsibility as an investor, you know, is to provide a return to my investors. I'm sorry to say that that's sort of the first point of business. But the way we find it, just back to your original question, find this connection between, you know, an entrepreneurial team, a great device, and a great market opportunity. Again, not rocket science. You put those three together and it happens to be in women's health. Again, 50% of the world's population, who can ask more than that? So, yeah, I would love, of course, for this to work because you prove a point. But my business is not to prove a point. My business is the one I described before. But still, it really feels good to be able to provide something and then that patients will be able to have their change, you know, their life changed thanks to the investment that you've made. So it's a really nice part of our job.
Well, it sounds like a fantastic medtech story, and I really appreciate the perspective on where we're headed with the investments in women's health. And Morrissey and Antoine Papernick, thanks for joining me on the podcast.
Thank you
for having us.
Have a great day.
All right, well, that is a wrap. Thanks so much for joining us on this episode of the Device Talks Weekly Podcast. Once again, make sure you join us at Device Talks West. Go to west.devicetalks.com to check out our speakers and agendas. No Device Talks Tuesdays next week. No Device Talks Weekly next week. We'll be unveiling our new Device Talks podcast network series, and it'll come out next Friday. So make sure you're subscribing to the Device Talks podcast network on any major podcast player, including YouTube. We're on YouTube now. So if you listen to your podcast on YouTube, as many people do, you can find Device Talks there as well. I'm off next week. I'll be back the week after that. We'll have more podcasts for you then. And that's it, folks. Follow us on, connect with us on LinkedIn. Connect with me. Connect with Chris Newmarker. Connect with Kayleen Brown. And give us a ranking on the podcast players as well. Going back to that, it does help people find the podcast, and it's nice to see all those pretty stars. So, thanks again for listening to this episode of the Device Talks Weekly Podcast. And have a great week. We'll talk to you in 2 weeks. Take care, everybody.